Good day, eh?
Good day.
Good day, eh? And welcome to another Fortside Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between, with a heavy focus on talent in the Great White North.
We're talking about Canada, eh? And today on the show, we've got Matthew Harris coming out of Perryville, Maryland. Matthew's been at this for quite a while, though, like 27 years. The man started with an apprenticeship of a master blacksmith from Amsterdam, Holland. He worked with the guy for 3 years, and now, 27 years later, this guy is a fully functioning blacksmith shop that is putting out, like, mind-blowing work. We are super excited to have Matt on the show today. Welcome to the show, Matt. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me, and thank you for that stellar introduction.
You deserve it, man. Your work is literally something I am in awe of, man. I love it. I love it. Absolutely.
Real gorgeous stuff, dude.
If you don't mind, we'll actually just start off with a quick little spiel here from Grumpy McGrumpface here. My friend Nick Verbray from Ottawa, Old Soldier Tool Works. How you been, dude? What's new with you, man?
Not too much. I've been doing pretty good. I just finished up a rounding hammer for Jed Phillips. When you guys were on the podcast and I was at Cloud College, it came up that she was in dire need of a better forging hammer. So I reached out to her, saw kind of like what she was looking for, and I got one whipped up right here.
Oh, nice. It's not in the mail yet. I thought maybe you'd have it out already. That's beauty, bud.
No, it'll go out later today, probably.
Looked like it had a nice curly maple handle in there.
Yeah, I kind of figured, why not?
That's beauty, man. Beauty. Well done. Well done.
Yeah. How about yourself, Lando? How you doing?
Oddly enough, I started working on a hammer myself. While she wanted a hammer from me, I've got a hammer in this weekend. Geez, when are we going to get this podcast out? Because I still got to get the Peter LePay episode out that we recorded a week or so ago there. So I'm a little bit behind on getting the podcast out. I apologize for that. I want to blame technical difficulties and a little bit of an explanation to that. My computer that I use normally is out of date and won't let me update it anymore. It's just like, nope, not happening.
Ruh-roh.
So I, for the last little bit, have been borrowing my wife's laptop, which worked fine, but she needs it. And today she was like, there's no way I can let you have it. I need it today. Like, I don't know what you're going to do, dude. You need to figure it out. It's like, fuck. I've been looking at this for a while and I knew it was coming. Headed on down to Staples and I bought myself a Chromebook laptop for like $200, dude.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and then no sooner did I leave Staples and I ran out to meet up with some boys from the Funk Factory. There's a welding shop here in just outside of Winnipeg called the Funk Factory, run by a gentleman, Kevin Funk. And he had a Beverly shear for sale. I finally got myself the Beverly shear that I've wanted for a few years now. It's an original Beverly shear. And I'm pumped to be adding that to my collection, man.
Oh, darn, you want to keep it. I was going to ask you, maybe if you want to part with it, bring it down to Can Iron. I would have grabbed it from you.
I don't know what's going on with Can Iron, man. I got a little bit of a behind-the-scenes whiff that it might not go down this year.
What?
Yeah, apparently people signing up for it are a little on the slow side here.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm signed up for it.
Are you? Oh, okay. Well, I'm a slacker and I haven't yet. And I'm just, you know, I was kind of thinking of doing it last minute kind of deal here. Well, part of the issue is there's a lot going on in my family right now with just stuff. It's tough to get into the depths of it, but there's just, it's all family related, dude. So it's, and family comes first, right? That's how it goes. But if it works out, man,
yes, that is obviously true.
Definitely want to be heading out to Can Iron. So it's, I really hope that it's not canceled and that the numbers are up there. Have you ever attended something like Can Iron or the Abana programs, Matt?
I've never been to Can Iron. I've always wanted to go, though. I've definitely been to Vanna several times. I demonstrated at Vanna back in 2014. So,
Nice.
Love a good conference.
What kind of demonstration did you do for Vanna?
My friend Mike Robert and I, we did a forged sculptural anvil that morphed into a painting of a blacksmith coming off of the anvil. My friend Mike is a super talented watercolor artist. So it was a pretty crazy piece. I'll try to maybe post a picture on my social media. So cool. As a follow-up. It's hard to describe.
Oh, I'd love to.
Yeah, I'm having a bit of a tough time conceptualizing it, but it sounds awesome.
Yeah. I have on my wall... this is the actual painting that was coming off of it. I don't know if you can see that, but it's like a it's a skeleton of a blacksmith. He's holding a tong and a hammer.
Yeah.
And there was like a framework that went around this with like forged fire coming off of it. And then that connected to kind of a stylized anvil below. Huh. So,
oh, that's awesome.
It was a different piece, but very cool project. And Mike's a great friend, longtime friend of the craft from one of the second shops that I worked in before starting mine. So, yeah.
Is he on Instagram?
He is. Michael Robert Art, spelled R-O-B-E-A-R, as in a bear. So,
cool. But,
yeah.
To give him a checkout.
Right on. That's our first shout out already. Look at this.
Yep. Shout out, Mike.
So how's your week been going? What have you been up to this week?
Week's been going great. Very busy week. Here in the shop, we are just absolutely cranking. So juggling a lot of things. We're kind of, you know, experiencing some growing pains. But just on a practical side, just, you know, handling all the regular business admin stuff that I do. But also my hand is still like very much in the shop, on the shop floor. Like, for instance, earlier today, we were working on like 4 sculptural garden railings. So I forged all the cap rail for that on the nasal. And we forged a bunch of sculptural. It's kind of like the design is on this one's called Windswept. And that's kind of very accurate of what it looks like. Just a bunch of, you know, kind of whimsical elements blowing in the wind, you know, cool piece. So yeah, we have a bunch of really good stuff going on. It's hard. We honestly have more going on than we ever have. And yeah, there's if you wanted a quick overview, I could give you like a look into about 5 different projects. We just wrapped up some stainless steel garden trellises, and each corner of the trellis had different forged flowers. So like we did these forged dahlias. They're on Instagram.
I saw that. Those are amazing, dude.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. And shout out to my guys, Jared and Drew. They did a lot of work on those as well. Dahlias, zinnia flowers, sunflowers, just a really cool mix of like detail to, you know, what was kind of like forged and fabricated. So that was one project. We're getting ready to start a project I'm super psyched about that we've had in the works for a couple months. And I love forging bronze. So this project is forged bronze.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't, you know, because of money, we don't get the chance to forge bronze every day. Mm-hmm. But when it comes along, it's really cool. So have you guys forged bronze?
That's something I haven't done yet.
I have played around with it. I got lots of questions to ask you about it, actually. So what kind of bronze specifically are you forging?
This is 655 silicon bronze.
Silicon bronze.
Yeah. Okay. There are a couple other, I know like Coal Iron Works, they sell some chunks of, I think, of an aluminum alloy bronze. Yeah. I haven't actually even tried that alloy yet. But I love bronze because, like, I mean, bronze definitely is not as forgiving as, like, mild steel to forge. Like, there are limitations. It doesn't want to maybe, you know, become as delicate or, I don't know, when you work it down, it's kind of a slower, more patient process.
That is certainly what I discovered.
Yeah, it will teach you quickly because, I mean, as you know, if you overheat it, it just becomes molten, melts away into nothing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not hot enough, there's a slight danger of cracking it off from just stress fractures and such.
Yeah, that's kind of what I ran into. I've been forging like aluminum bronze, and it does not like forging very much.
Okay, gotcha.
It does.
Yeah, like I said, I haven't done aluminum. Okay, yeah, the different alloys, it's night or day from one to the next. So that's why I like silicon bronze. I've had good success with that. I've also had great success with, if you want to get into forging bronze, but you want to do it on the cheap side and kind of get your feet wet, a great alloy is 464 naval brass. And it's technically not a bronze, but it acts exactly like bronze. It's cheaper to buy, almost half the cost of bronze.
Oh, wow. Really?
And it forges like really amazing as well. Naval brass. It's called naval brass or naval bronze, 464. Great alloy, and super less painful financially to learn on, because if you melt a piece away, it's just not quite as bad. But
I've also been the kind of silly person that has made my own bronze.
Okay,
I actually played around with it with my buddy Terry Cash of Clue Aaron Forges Induction Forge. That thing you can actually set it up with a little crucible, and we played around with a couple different mixes of copper and aluminum for making aluminum bronze. I mean, it turns out super cool. It's just forging it is difficult. It is very, it doesn't like to move. And once you do get it moving, you've got a very small window before you've got to get it back into the forge. You've got to contemplate making sure that you're annealing it often enough because it likes to crack.
And anneals the same way as copper does?
Kind of.
Okay.
Some aluminum bronze will actually harden if quenched.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So I've been playing around with both, like, annealing and sort of, like, heating up, to sort of, like, dull orange and letting it sit, versus heating it up and then quenching it off. It's kind of hard to tell which is working best. It's still very much in the experimental phase.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of it comes down to the alloy mixture that's used, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Because like with silicon bronze, all of the forging that we do on that is actually done hot while it's still red hot. So, and it'll take that. And then when it gets down to a black heat, reheat to a light red and keep going. So you kind of keep it all right in that light red, not too hot, not too cold. You're good to go with that. We've also done some projects. Like we did a crazy project about 5 years ago that was a reproduction of a copper Indian that was done all out of copper sheet metal. So like that was all done cold and then constantly heating up, re-annealing. Mm-hmm. Classic, like, steep metal copper approach. Once it work hardens, re-anneal it, go back to work.
Yeah. So,
you done a bunch of copper work, Lando?
I've done a bunch of copper work myself. Well, the roses I make I make a lot of copper roses, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry.
And I do all of that cold. I do all of that cold. I've tried doing a little bit of heat into those, but I don't like how it looks afterwards, and you cannot restore the copper back to what it was prior to forging it. I can't get that. On the flower anyways, if it was sheet metal, give it a bit of a buff or whatever, but you can't get into the contours of the flower with any sort of tooling.
Oh, yeah,
and any sort of acid that I've tried to use doesn't bring... It gives it an odd patina, I find. I don't know. Do you have any experience with that, Matthew?
Yeah, that's always a fight. My experience has been the same. Like, with those big copper Indians that we did, we pickled them with pickling salt to like clean them, but that does give an odd kind of iridescent, like weird patina to it. And then you got to kind of brown it out, treat it with your own version on top of that, something different. So
now, actually,
it's always a consideration.
Last copper rose that I did that I tried doing a chemical finish to, I did citric acid bath, and it gave it a good shine, but it also, what's the word for, is it iridescent that you get the like rainbowish like flash off of different lights? Yeah. So it gave in weird spots, I got in like an iridescent finish to it. It was like very cool, but at the same time, I just, it's not what I wanted. So it was kind of threw me off that that's what it ended up in. But yeah. Okay, the stainless steel work, dude, that's, I have got a huge, huge gravitation to wanting to do stainless steel work. What alloy of stainless are you using?
The trellises that we just finished up were all 304, which is a low, like mid-grade alloy. But like the reason for that was we were, the final product looked exactly like wrought iron. It was painted. You honestly wouldn't know it was stainless. We just did stainless for longevity and like no rust bleeding. It's just like, I've begun to offer it, you know, as a high quality alternative to just, you know, forge mild steel if the budget's there for it. And, but yeah, we have another project coming up. We're going to forge some, 316L on that. That has a little bit more nickel and chromium in it. Better corrosion resistance, of course, than 304. But yeah, those are the two most common.
So when you do the 316, is there a finishing process to that in order to obtain a corrosion resistant surface after foraging?
Yes, you know, like an electro etch, like something like a Walter Surfox, you know, where you go in with that, you know, little brush and take the weld flash, you know, out of it, so to speak. You know, you have to passivate it somehow, be that through a chemical process or electro etch, or there's actually companies out there that you can send like your whole entire product to. They'll just you know, dip it in a bath of, you know, nitric acid and passivate the entire thing. That's like always the best approach if time and budget allows. But the other way, you know, a lot of guys do is just with the electro etch brushes, because, you know, you can control it in-house, just one small area and you're done.
Yeah, that nitric acid stuff is not exactly the most fun to be using in a, especially in a small shop. If you've got a small shop and not good ventilation, yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, like a lot of the stuff that we do in stainless, the approach to it is kind of very much like wrought iron. Like when we finish it, a lot of times it's painted, it, or it'll have some type of patina on top of it. So it's not like stainless in the regards that a lot of people think, and shiny, polished, you know, all of that. We do a lot of forged stainless that, you know, when we're done with it, you would never know it's stainless, other than the fact that some dude 150 years from now will hopefully stand and look at it and be like, wow, that's really beautiful. You know, they were smart enough to use stainless. It's not all eaten away. You know, some thought given to like the heritage and longevity of the work is kind of like the approach. It's not like, you know, shiny stainless like a lot of people do.
Right. Have you ever seen, there was a TV series, I think on History Channel or something like that, where it talked about if civilization was to ever fall out, the what would remain of human civilization hundreds of years from now. And the main thing that would still be standing is anything made of stainless steel.
Wow. Yeah.
It'd be pretty
cool. That and maybe titanium, I would imagine.
Titanium, just... yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah, it'd probably still last. Yeah. Do you do a lot of forging with stainless?
Yes, we do. Quite a bit. Yeah. This past project. Matter of fact, one that we're wrapping up now and two past projects, were all done in stainless, and there was a lot of forging on them. So Yeah, and I mean, when I say forging, like, a lot of that's done with power hammers, you know, because stainless is so tough.
It is brutish to move. It is. Miserable shit.
Yeah.
And 316 is the worst.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, 304 is bad, but like 316 is such miserable stuff to forge. It's like trying to forge like H13 or S7.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I tell people
chromium levels are similar in the two, dude.
Oh, yeah. But I tell people, like, working 1-inch square stainless is like the equivalent of working 1.5-inch square mild steel. And never was that more pronounced than I did a sculpture. It had a huge stainless steel heart in it, and the ends of the hearts were like a forged scroll. So it was a combination of like a hollow form heart that the ends and the tips were all forged and, you know, welded in seamlessly. So it was one, you know, piece. But those two ends of that heart were 3-inch square stainless. And oh my gosh, like, whoa. The only way that we moved it, like, we basically worked it. I have a 200-ton hydraulic press. We basically worked it in the 200-ton press, kind of like you would at the anvil with a hammer, but just, you know, in the 200-ton press, because that's the only way you're moving it.
Yeah. No
kidding. Oh, tell me about your tools. Tools. No, tools. Tell me about your tools.
Yeah, I think we need to get a bit of a picture of what your shop setup looks like, man.
No kidding, dude. 200-ton press, my God.
Yes, sir.
And the nasal and all this other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a small YouTube channel, and actually I've been meaning to do we kind of have two sides of the shop, and I'm getting ready to do kind of like two little quick tour videos, that what I call the fab side, which is like our main assembly side. That space is like 30 by 50. And then the old shop, which is kind of the forge shop, which is where I started, that is like 24 by 60. And so, quick look in the forge shop, we have 800-pound Nalspermet steam hammer. It's not currently
running.
It's not currently running. I need a air-powered compressor for that. Mm. But it does run. We've run it for events. Awesome hammer. We have a nasal 3B, 280-pound ram nasal 2B. Yeah, 165-pound ram. And then we have a 100-pound utility hammer, kind of like a Kenyan style, you know, just classic, like big blue style hammer. A lot of people have.
Like and an then external we have, compressor one?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then we have like what might be my favorite hammer, which is a 35-pound mechanical Champion number O hammer.
No way.
And I just say favorite because like that hammer built my business, you know, back when I was like working on my dad's shed, before I had any of the other cool hammers that I have now. So yeah, did insane amount of work on that little hammer. Like I had one job. I remember drawing down on the hard some 1-inch by 3-inch stock on that little 35-pound mechanical hammer.
My God.
And you did it, man. Just, you know.
Crazy absolute stuff. Workhorse. Yep.
Yeah. So like, you know, I do have an incredible shop, and I don't say that arrogantly. I'm extremely thankful for what we've been able to build up, but I always like encourage people starting out, you know, don't look down on what you have today, because even I started out with like a railroad track anvil and a small coal forge, you know, working out of a little shed with a dirt floor in my dad's backyard. So, you know, don't ever let anyone talk down about your work if you only have minimal tools, and don't look down on yourself. You know, just produce the best work you can, no matter where you're at in your, you know, in your phase. I'm really passionate about
that. Absolutely.
Because I just feel like, you know, sometimes when you get to the level of work that our shop's doing, you can kind of become arrogant. And I just, you know, I refuse to not remember my roots and just be thankful and grateful for, you know, where I came from. So
that's a
hell yeah, man.
Yeah. No, that's very warm, heartening to hear that. On
one side of it, you know, to be humble as you grow, to stay humble. But I got to wonder, on the other side of that, as a young maker, at what point do you decide that you're good enough? Or do you just go with it right from the hop?
Yeah, so...
You're going deep into the philosophy at this point. Yeah, all right, no, let's roll with it.
That's a great question. That's a great question.
It is, it is.
Yeah, I mean, I can only really answer that from my own experience. I think I had the advantage of starting so young. I mean, I was 14 when I started my apprenticeship, you know, spent 3.5 years with a master blacksmith.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah, that is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I was homeschooled so I could juggle it around that. And then from, I don't want to gloss over that apprenticeship. It was an absolute foundation of everything that I am.
Oh, dude. And I want to hear more about it for sure.
Yeah, everything that, you know, I did after that. So, like, my first day of my apprenticeship, I remember I went there and he had a bunch of, like, 1-inch round pieces that were cut out of a huge coil of mild steel. First thing he had me do was, like, straighten these pieces, which are, like, half circles, straighten them out cold. So I learned how metal moved cold. Like, you know, on a very small scale. So you can just feel the spring and just, you know, the hammer hitting the metal and just the raw basics. And then once those pieces were done, we took them to the coal forge and actually forge welded them together into a basket handle.
No.
So kind of from extremely basic to somewhat complex, but I didn't even realize what he was doing, but the philosophy in the long run was basically approach everything with basic, simple steps in mind. And, you know, you'll wind up with, you know, wherever you want to go in the final product, you know, almost taking like some of the, you know, intimidation factor out of it from the get go with starting with forge welding. So
that's a very good way to get someone's grasp on the whole process. You know, you start them off complicated and you can very easily scare somebody, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, his approach was, Mr. Molenschott's approach was very disciplined. He, you know, he's European. You don't forsake your roots. You are what you are. It was kind of a culture that I had never experienced and, you know, being immersed into his world and his shop and a very disciplined way of learning the craft. And then, you know, like I've heard you guys talk about, you know, learning on YouTube, and that's like the, you know, exact opposite of it. And, you know, again, like someone asked me, you know, not long ago about that, like, hey, you know, what do you think about people just going out and learning on their own? Number one, I know some incredible talented people who've learned on their own. So there's something intuitive about the craft where I always say, even if you don't start out with the respect that blacksmithing deserves, it will force itself upon you in the long run. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Nothing's that you burn up and screw up and all that stuff.
There's a lot of fuck around and find out in blacksmithing.
Always yes, there. Is.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just my, you know, insertion into the craft was different than a lot of people, but, you know, the end result was awesome. I'm super thankful for everything that Mr. Molenschott taught me. And then after that apprenticeship, I went on to work in 3 other shops, all 3 shops were very varied. The one was very high-end architectural, forged hardware, not ironwork, just hardware only, like hinges, latches, locks. That was a great experience. The other shop, because I worked 4/10s Monday through Thursday there, and then I jumped up to an industrial forge in Philly on Fridays, Italian shop. Funny story there. Yeah, very cool place. Funny story there. Like the owner was a great guy. He was older, getting ready to retire. I was the last blacksmith employed there. And he had a blacksmith named Rocco who was like first generation Italian. And the owner would have him like train me and teach me some stuff. And his Italian accent was so thick, even with 3.5 years with Mr. Mullinshot and learning a European accent, I couldn't understand what this guy was saying. So it's like this communication barrier.
I mean, Dutch accents and Italian accents are not exactly that alike.
No, you're right about that. But, you know, you'd like to think you can understand it. Anyhow, he would explain something to me. I'd ask him to repeat it like 3 or 4 times, and he'd just walk away, cussing me out. And but, yeah, that was a great shot. You know, learned kind of larger scale forging there. And then I went to work in another shop doing very similar work to what we're doing now, which is, you know, large scale architectural work and sculpture. So, yeah.
Was there a thought process prior to working in some of those shops as to that's the direction you wanted to take? Was work in multiple shops to gain more experience? Was that something that came from Mr. Mullinshot? Like, hey, young one, it's a good idea to get out there and gain the experience in multiple shops. Don't focus on one aspect. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah, so a couple different answers to that. So that kind of gets back to the last question that I didn't answer, which is like, when do you go out on your own? But my, you know, I kind of viewed all of that as a journeymanship. And the approach was, let me get my foot in as many different doors as I can so that when I do open my doors, I'm as well-rounded as I possibly can. Because if you've only been exposed to one thing in one shop, that's all you know.
Yeah.
But I did take advantage of the fact that I was young. I mean, I'm doing all this when I'm like 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, hopping around all these shops, just, you know. And I became known, you know, shop owners talked to one another, and I made sure that any shop I went into, they made money off of what I was doing. You know, I worked hard. I don't fool around. So that opens up a lot of doors. Just working hard opens up a lot of doors. So,
sure,
you know,
freaking does, man. People want that. That's like, you know, you will seek that out if you know of it. I don't mean to interrupt though, but I gotta wonder, did you have the intuition that you knew you were going to have your own shop one day right from being a young man?
Yeah, I would say about halfway through my apprenticeship, I was probably about 16, and I began to dream about having my own shop. I knew I wasn't ready. Yeah, you know, I just kind of fell in love with the craft. I knew it was something I wanted to do long term. I actually, at that point, was trying to do it in knives. And I studied with some really good knife makers, was doing the whole Damascus thing. And then I fell into the architectural side of things. And I began to see, wow, you can really go so many different ways with this type of work. And there is a market for it. And so, yeah, back then I began to kind of dream about having my own shop. And if I can answer the question you had before about, like, when do you know you're ready? You know, that's hard. And I don't think anyone ever really knows that. But I had been working at the one company doing the forged hardware work for about 6 years. And I just got this burning desire to finally jump ship and do my own thing. Heidi and I had been married about 2 years at this point. And so I had given my boss like 6 months notice because I didn't want to leave them in large because blacksmiths weren't as common back then. And about halfway through that 6 months, we found out that she was pregnant with our first daughter. So you're already second guessing doing this huge jump. And then you find out, wow, our family's totally changing and all that. But I just had, I want to say 24 then. And I just had this like underlying thought of, well, two thoughts. What's the worst that can happen? You know, I fail, take on some debt and go work my butt off to pay that back. But my biggest fear was that I wouldn't jump ship then. You know, you blink, 15 years goes by and you're filled with nothing but regret that you didn't try it. So, on one hand, I wasn't ready at 24. I was super, motivated. The one thing I will say is like, my work ethic made up for my lack of knowledge. So I would get in trouble in different ways, but you're not going to outwork me. You know, back in those days, I just, you know, just worked constantly. I worked 54 hours straight one time to get a job out the door, you know, without sleeping.
Oh, my God. That's going to leave you somewhat delirious by the end of that, I bet.
Oh, absolutely. You just crash for like 2 days after it's all said and done.
I know what that's like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, work ethic makes up for lack of knowledge early on.
Well, there's three things that can make a really solid employee. It's work ethic, the ability to finish the work and do a good job and finish the work. And the other one is to be there all the time. If you can get two of those things out of your employee, you've won. But good fucking luck finding that in people nowadays.
Yeah. You know, that's a whole nother side of things. So we do have employees now and we're experiencing some growing pains and adding people in. But I also like refuse to take on the philosophy that there aren't good people out there who don't want to do work with their hands. Cause there are, they're definitely more rare.
There absolutely are.
Yeah. But you know, like, I'm not the only guy who wants to work hard. You know, I'm not going to be that arrogant. You know what I mean? Just, mm-hmm. you know, there's other people out there who are still passionate about this. It's easy to, you know, look around and get discouraged sometimes, but it's just like, I'm not going to buy all that bull crap that you can't find people. Cause I have two great, awesome dudes now. Sure, there's more. And I mean, talking quickly about like people working for you though, that's a whole nother thing. And I always, both my guys started off as apprentices here and worked their way into like a paid position. And I always tell people, like, I'm huge on keeping a great, you know, environment within your shop. Cause I told them, I was like, okay, so we don't have to be best friends, but like, you're not allowed to make me miserable. Cause if I'm miserable, you know, this isn't going to work out. It's just that simple. You know? Like,
I mean, that's fair, right?
Like, you look at it.
You know, that's a pretty low bar to clear. Don't make miserable.
The reality is we've all worked with people that we didn't like and didn't want to. And I'm just like, my whole thing is we work, you know, in this craft, you work too hard to be miserable. Like, not to say that there's not days where, you know, you just got to suck it up and get through the day. You know, not every day.
There's always miserable days.
Yeah. But for the most part, just a great, you know, culture and enjoying the work that you're doing. I love my space. We have a great space here. And then doing it with great people. That's, you know, kind of my approach. So.
Well, I really appreciate the idea of ensuring that as an employee, you have value to you for your employer. And in, like, in the aspect of whatever you do for your boss is going to turn around and help your boss, help the company gain, right? You're not taking advantage of the situation whatsoever. You're always on the page that you're helping the company grow.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, at the end of the day, that's all any of us want. It doesn't matter if you own the business or you're working in a business. You want your work to be appreciated. I want, you know, on the side, you know, I want our clients to appreciate it. Then on the flip side, I want my guys to know, hey, you did good work. I appreciate your input into this project. So, you know, that's something at the core of all of us. You want.
You'd be surprised. I work in production, and I see a lot of not that attitude.
Well, I would agree with that in that environment, but I'm talking about an environment of like a maker, a craftsman, an artist.
Yeah.
So that, yes, in a GM factory where you're just slapping cars together, there might not be that. Yeah. But if you're like, you know, working in, you know, part-time shop or full-time shop like ours, and you're a maker, an artisan, you know, your work has to be that. Because you're literally putting yourself into the work. So my philosophy. That's what I find with the people I hang out in this community and this craft.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. In the Walmart stocking job.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, I care so much about my job. Oh, shit. No, you're making me think a lot. Like the gentleman that I just went and picked up that Beverly shear, and the two gents that were working in the yard for this Kevin Funk guy, I could feel that they care for the company just in the quick conversation that we had, and I gained a lot of respect for them and for the company that they worked for simply by having that short conversation and seeing that they care. they actually offered me a job while I was there, and I was like, ah, you know, seems like a really good place, you guys, but hard to give up the job I've got right now for 15 years. So, yeah,
that's cool. Wait a second, Lando. Doesn't your job make you bloody miserable half the time?
Yes. No. I'm trying to.
Well, they're not going to bring it up on the podcast, yeah, but okay.
I've been trying to avoid conversation in that aspect for quite some time.
No, but like, if I can interject something here, like, I think just to be raw and real for a moment, I think sometimes people look at like what I'm doing, and they're like, oh, that's the best job ever. You know, every day's a holiday. And while it is, like, I have some days that I just look around, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this work with these people. But then on the flip side, like, especially running your own business, there's days where, you know, it's really miserable and super stressful. And you're just like, man, am I doing the right thing? So, you know, I've been running my own shop 18 years. I've had plenty of days where I've, you know, second guessed and be like, ah, should I go get a real job, quote unquote?
Yeah, questioning your life decisions. Yeah, I think we've all done that.
Let me ask you something a little bit personal maybe here. How much vacation time do you take?
Not enough. I know that for sure. And it's a great question. I know the purpose behind it. But that's something my wife has been good to try to make us be more deliberate about taking. But yeah, we usually only take like one full week off a year and then try to interject, as many, you know, weekends or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, there's a side to that, because when you own your own business, it gives you the opportunity to take an hour in the middle of the day, possibly to deal with, you know, your own stuff or your family, whatever. When you work for somebody else, a lot of the time you don't get that. So all those 1 hour here, 1 hour there, it all adds up. And, you know, you either take 2 solid weeks of vacation or whatever, spread out 2 weeks of vacation over a year or 3 weeks of vacation over a year, or you take that 1 week and get to add in an hour a day here or there or whatever and make life not miserable, essentially.
Sorry,
what is this vacation you speak of?
Oh, yeah, right. You're on permanent vacation. I forgot.
It's complicated.
Yeah, I know.
permanent vacation, but never out of the shop for more than a day.
Well, but then there's that's the other side to it is, as a maker, what we do, like, work is enjoyable to us. Our work is like a vacation almost. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I'm taking my weekend and I'm going to go work all weekend, but I'm going to fucking love every second of it.
You know, like, I do absolutely love it. I don't know if I'd call it a vacation. It's not like that, but it certainly helps keep me sane.
It's my personal vacation. Other people would not look at this as a vacation. Other people would be like, what the fuck, dude, you're crazy. A lot of people do say that about me, but whatever. Maybe about
for many thing, reasons. Maybe. For many reasons, Lando.
Thanks, bud.
No, but to your point, like, about that, jumping out of the shop for an hour, that is one of the great advantages. And my kids are in high school. My oldest daughter just graduated. And I've always, like, been super disciplined about, you know, trying to come in early so I could jump out early to go watch a volleyball game or a basketball game. Because, like, you know, life goes fast and that's just a small season. And being driven and running your own business is one thing. But I have watched some, you know, business people be so driven that they left their families behind. Mm-hmm. I've tried my best to, you know, like we all do, to juggle, you know, business and family and be deliberate about, you know, being present for my kids and all that. So, yeah.
I hear that, man. My wife is a very strong advocate of playing that card. And she runs her own business. She owns a cleaning business. They do house and offices and stuff like that. And it's something that I've seen through her that Yeah, sure. I could have focused on the business more. It could have grown more. It could be at the point where, you know, we're rolling. The money's rolling in. We're doing good. We're laughing type thing or whatever. But then the family suffers. There's got to be a balance to all of that. Balance is key.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And even so that's what I'm missing. Any and all balance.
I'd say that's part of your overly large.
It's part of my problem.
It's your overly large figure being like over 6 foot tall and 300 pounds. It's hard to have balance in that, man.
Is that a fat joke? God damn, man. That's cold.
It was a big joke.
Especially making fun of the big.
You're like,
the big guy who's only got one working foot who can't keep his balance. Well, yeah.
There's that too. Yeah, add that to your balance. I'd like to see you on a, even with a good foot, I'd like to see you on a skateboard.
Oh, that would be comical.
Right? Just this giant dude on a skateboard.
It's you gotta get one of those really big little banana boards.
It's not that you're fat, dude. You're just a big fucking dude.
I am at least a little bit fat. Let's be frank.
I wasn't playing that card.
Out, shots fired.
Yeah. I guess so. Sorry, I didn't mean it like that. Fuck.
No, that's all right.
Dig myself holes, man. That's what I do. Shit.
It is. I've seen your posts on Facebook.
Yeah. Don't look at my face.
Every time. It's just like, don't look at Lando's face.
Oh, that's a hot mess.
So why don't you tell us a little bit more about some of the intricacies of the architectural work you're doing, like the railings. Like, I have done exactly one railing, and it was miserable, and I hated it, and I swore that I'd never do it again. Fire away. Tell us what it's like.
Yeah, the architectural work, like you say, that is a discipline unto itself. And the precision, the form, the function, the design, the execution, the fit, the finish, all these things play into it. And it's definitely a learned process. And, you know, I've had some early on, I had some painful, you know, ways of learning. You know, you make some mistakes when you first start out, but now we're at a good point where we've kind of over the years developed you know, a certain system where, you know, before I wasn't always doing shop drawings, you know, just go out and make a template, build the piece, so to speak. Now we've gotten to the point where, you know, we'll generate shop drawings and work from those and do some templates still, but now, architecture work's very challenging. The expectation is very high on the, you know, the customer side always, you know, because we're doing high end work. So, they, you know, there's a certain level of fit and finish and, you know, just everything that goes into it, you know, that's expected. And that's why I still do a lot of sculptural work. And that's kind of how I keep my sanity, is like I do balance it in the sense of our mainstay definitely is architectural work. And it's a grueling, our industry is a grueling industry. Like, you know, the level of work that you have to produce just day in, day out. And the margin for error, I would say, is the hardest part. You know, like there's little to no margin for error. So, And you're also generating a largely handmade product. So I've come to learn, like, where's that balance of precision and then where's that balance of handmade? And that's different for each craftsman. But for us, I've kind of drawn the lines with different things. Like, for instance, we're getting ready to do a project right now that'll have a forged cap rail on it. And that's hammered out and forged. But at the same time, when the customer puts their hand on it, you know, it can't have, you know, anything sharp, you know, and it needs to be a balance of, yeah, you run your hand up and down it, you feel this beautiful forged texture, but at the same time, it's been sanded and thoughtfully finished so that it's usable and it's not, you know, it doesn't hurt your hand. You know what I mean?
So, something like that, yeah, done with die sets?
Yes, Wolfwards, a lot of that with dies on the power hammer.
You guys make your own dies?
Yes, we do. So,
what's your go-to material for dies?
Like a 4140. I mean, that's super common.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
H13, you know, those are the two big ones. I have a big stock of Atlantic 33, the Flutagon.
Oh, yeah.
For like that. That's not so much for dies, but that's more for tooling.
Yeah.
And I got a load of that out of the industrial shop I worked at in Philly. But yeah, 4140, H13. But that comes, a lot of that comes out of working in hardware and learning tooling to make hardware.
Right.
And so that kind of just, yeah, there's a tooling in hardware. It's just a, hardware is an intensive, you know, tooling business. So I just
translated that. All jigs and dies.
Yeah. Yeah.
That Atlantic 33 stuff, I've heard a lot of good stuff about it. A lot of people are saying how amazing it is. And I know Lawrence Lake over at Maritime Knife Supply has brought in a good supply of it. And if you're ever looking for Atlantic 33, this is for all of our listeners. If you're ever looking for Atlantic 33 steel, you can order it through Maritime Knife Supply. You head over to maritimeknifesupply.com or .ca. Go look through the products he's got available. There's Atlantic 33 in there. He's got wrought iron. You can save yourself $100 on Evenheat or Paragon kilns if you use the FSC kiln code on checkout. And save yourself 10% on grinding belts, too. If you buy 10, you'll get one for free. That's at maritimeknifesupply.com or .ca.
Wow, look at how smooth that ad read was. Damn, dude.
Not bad, eh?
That's probably the best you've ever done. That was amazing. That was so, that was the best transition ever.
You've said that before. You've said that.
Yeah, well, it just keeps getting better.
That's what she said.
That was good. So, Matt, have you actually done much work with the Atlantic 33?
Yes.
I've got a chunk of it, but you know, I haven't played with it yet.
Yeah, more for you know, like punches and drifts and that type of work. But yeah, it's super forgiving in the sense of it's, you know, it's that one steel that you can, you know, harden without tempering. And then while you're working, if you get a tool stuck, you know, it becomes red hot, you can quench it again and no issues. So that's,
yeah,
you know, it's super forgiving.
Right on. I probably need to make myself a new hammer drift, so I might do that. Might use that.
Yeah, that would be a great application for it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's actually kind of interesting to hear you talking about sort of the relative sort of differences between the handwork that you need to do and then also having the precision at the end where everything's going to fit in. Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know if you want to put it that I'm doing that in microcosm, doing woodworking tools, very, very small tolerances, but on much smaller pieces, or you're doing the macro version. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, are you usually doing your projects and installs on new builds?
It is a combination of both renovations and new builds, but yes, a lot of new builds.
Yeah, because I can imagine the renos is just that extra level of challenge.
Yes, renovations are always challenging, for sure. But yeah, every job has its own unique challenge to it.
Yeah, are the guys you work with normally pretty good with giving you nice flat square openings and spaces to actually fit your stuff into, or
no? And, I mean, it all depends. Some of the builders we work with are really good, and yeah, you'll get an amazing fit up, amazing space. You know, every wall is truly plumb and level and all of that. But we just finished up a gate that fit into what's called, you know, a barrel vault opening, which is, you know, has tiny flats on the sides, but, you know, goes into this huge arch. And so we fit this entire framework. I have yet to post a picture of this on Instagram, but we will soon. The entire framework fits up into that arch. Then you have to anchor it down to the floor. And then it had double gates, which double gates are always hard to get aligned and swing correctly.
Oh, yeah.
Fit into that. So things like that, you know, not every job is the same, but that was a challenge. But it
came out
really
sounds good. Like a lot of fiddle fuck.
Yes, definitely a high fiddle factor. So, yeah.
Is that something that is on a home, or is that like an office or something?
That piece was for a resort, and so kind of a commercial space. It was for a pool house and a transition space where they wanted access to the pool when the pool was open, and then these gates would close when they had other events, and they could like close off the pool but keep the rest of the event space open.
Right.
So that was a commercial dock. We do mix of residential and commercial, mainly high-end residential. But
how do you commercial. Get into finding that customer that wants that stuff?
I tell people where we are now is the benefit of sticking it out for 18 years and just gradually growing. So we never grew big fast, and we're not even big now, but we are honestly getting some really good jobs and good customers, and that's doing 18 years of good work and it catching up with you. So
yeah, I really do think that that's the kind of thing that you've got to anticipate if you're going to try to be getting into anything that's a high-end market.
Yes.
It's not going to be quick to get there. You're going to be doing a lot of small jobs with even smaller paydays before you get some of these big, you know.
Like there's a project that in my mind that really sticks out in this aspect. In the ski resort of Big White in British Columbia, just outside of the city of Kelowna, you go into their main reception building. And they've got a couple of window panels that are, it's all floral, artistic blacksmithing work. And the gentleman that did that work is out of Vancouver. How did that guy in Vancouver acquire a job for a ski resort 6-8 hours away from where he is? Did they seek him out? Did he get a whiff of the job through a bid contract of some sort? You know, I always got to wonder how the two people connect, right? What's the story behind how they met?
Yeah. So how does that work on your end? Yeah.
Yeah. That's always an interesting thing to look at, is how people find us. I shipped a gate to California. I've shipped work to Florida. Only small stuff internationally, but I mean, a lot of business is conducted by people who know people. Even with the internet, even with everything else, especially with high end work, you don't get it automatically right away. So, you know, somebody really has to know you, kind of recommend you. One job leads to another. It's funny how people find us through all different, you know, means. That's why I do social media. That's why I'm constantly putting our stuff out there. I just think if you run a business, you're insane to not post your work on social media. It's like the best form of advertising.
Yeah.
I've had people find us through that. But generally speaking, it's a lot of word of mouth, a lot of recommendations. Sometimes people will search something specific and find you through the website. We've had that happen before. But a lot of word of mouth, a lot of recommendations. But it is funny in the fact that some guy in Colorado will do a project, you know, an hour and a half from me. And, you know, then we'll turn around and we'll do a project that's 6 or 8 hours away. Yeah, so, you know, it's funny how that works.
Right.
Yeah, it does kind of happen that way. And I mean, sometimes it's right person for the right job. And sometimes it's just, you know, didn't know about the other guy, or they didn't know about you.
Yeah, but I think another layer of that is people do seek out a certain person and a certain style of work a lot of times. A lot of times it's as simple as a designer will have something in mind and your style will fit that the best. Because the amount of jobs that I've had that I never bid against anyone else on, would probably be pretty surprising. And then, you know, of course, you do bid against a lot of people and other stuff. But sometimes it's just a matter, like you say, of being the right artist or the right craftsman fit, you know, kind of exactly what they want. You know, it's amazing what is important to your customer. You know, it's never, and that's always something you're figuring out. Sometimes it's the finish. Sometimes it's the form that you executed on the other job. But, you know, all those details, you know, you got to keep track of.
Do you think? Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to ask, would you say that there are any sort of particular elements of your work that have like a sort of like signature style for you?
Good question.
Great question. I need to give that one a long answer because back when I first got done my apprenticeship, I go to work for the hardware shop. I'm working by my good friend, Mike Robert, that we wound up at demonstrating and banding together. And he had a profound impact on my life. Just one of the best artists I've ever worked with. And I remember him telling me, I'm probably like 19, 20 at this point. And I remember him telling me, then you don't even know your style and it'll take you a decade to work it out. And I remember being pissed and not wanting to hear that. but he was so right because your true style is something that when you look back on a lot of your work, it just gradually evolves and it's hard to figure out. And I see like some kids coming out of art school thinking they have their style figured out, but it's nothing more than what a bunch of professors pressed into them. Mm-hmm. And they don't have that decade of their own work to really let their own style bloom. So the long answer is yes. I think my work has a certain style, a lot of, you know, kind of free form sculptural work. I feel like the best work we do is a blend of architecture and sculpture. I've come to see a certain organic kind of arrested movement style in a lot of my sculptural work over the years. But yeah, it's a cup of tea. Gotta let that thing brew. you know, it's not automatic. It takes time.
For sure.
And I think the best work is that true work, not a regurgitated version of someone else's style or someone else's work. It's okay to be influenced and inspired, but there's a difference between copying and regurgitating someone's work and feeding off of that, changing it, letting it evolve into your own work. Because like, you know, I love Albert Paley like a lot of people, but I've never wanted to copy his work. You know, his work is his work. There's elements in mine that may reflect some of that because I love abstract, organic, sculptural, you know.
Well, I thought you were going to say you love abstract blacksmith. I was going to say, oh, thanks.
I do love abstract blacksmith as well. I'm on the podcast.
Yeah. Nice. No, I mean, I totally get what you're saying, that there's, you're always going to have influences, right? Like, you know, I think with like, you look at that hammer I just made, it's very clear that that comes from a lineage from the Brian Brazil.
Brian Brazil right there. Yeah.
Tool making. Right. But then I've got my own thing that I do, especially with things like my chisels, you know, whereas that's kind of something I've spent, you know, several years now kind of developing and making my own.
Yeah.
And based off of that too, I think that there's an element where it's not a bad idea to copy somebody else's work when you're in the beginning phases to get an understanding of process.
Emulate. The word you're looking for is emulate, not copy.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yes. But I mean, you know, there was a lot of copying the masters by the old painters too, to learn and study that way too. But no, like you were saying with your tooling and some of the things you create, I feel that kind of like some subtle things that become your signature style are hugely underrated. And I, you know, the world is so cluttered in a lot of ways that I feel like we don't give enough credit for like simple things that you earmark and you kind of make your own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it could be only slightly different than the way everyone else does it, but I think that's kind of the beauty behind the work is you find those things that make it unique to you. And that's, you know, one of the things you love and the reason we all, you know, go out in the shop and light the forge and, you know, pick up the hammer. Sometimes it's not huge things. It's, you know, small, subtle. But it, kind of in vain with that, a good friend of mine, Chris Cash, I'm sure you guys have heard of him, Mountainville Metalworks on Instagram.
I just interviewed. He was the last guy we interviewed, actually.
Oh, really?
I've got an interview I've got to put out from him, too. Yep.
Okay, awesome.
I love Chris. I think he's an amazing gent.
Yes, but he took one of my designs, and to his credit, he asked me if he could take it. He did a video on it. That video went viral on YouTube, and within a week, I'm seeing artists in Japan, Russia, all around the world replicating. And he called it the Dragon Twist. He marketed it differently,
right.
But that form, it started out for me as a spiky flower that I developed for some very organic gates.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
How long ago did you do that?
So I demonstrated that form at my hammer, and I want to say probably 10 years ago now. Okay. Chris did the video. I bet it's been every bit of 5 years ago that Chris did the video.
Yep.
I came up with the form about 15 to 16 years ago.
And, ahead of me, then.
I do take credit for that form. It's funny. Since he released that video, a lot of other people were trying to take credit for that form.
Yeah.
And I just want
to clarify, we are actually talking about like the Dragon Twist with the angled cuts coming in, but like, yes, done kind of like cubed to it.
The Dragon Twist, yes. That's my idea, which, again, to his credit, he kind of twist the branding on it and came up with the whole wording of Dragon Twist and did that video on it. It was a great video, but it was my form to begin with. And he was, you know, he's an awesome friend, total class act, gave me credit in the video, all those things.
Talks about you lots, man.
Yeah. So, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like in the history of forging and wrought iron work and all that stuff, it's hard to come up with like a new element, a new thing that, and I felt like that was, albeit if you really break it down, it's just a tapered, angled version of a Rubik's Cube's twist. You know what I mean?
It's weird because when Chris put that out, I commented on his video saying, whoa, holy fuck, I did something very similar to that about a year ago. I didn't finish it though. That was the problem, is I started doing it. I started twisting it and I kind of fucked up on the twist and I was like, I don't know. It's kind of meh, whatever. And I threw it in the scrap bin. And then like a year later, I saw him do it. I'm like, holy shit. That's what I could have done. Damn it. I had no idea.
I mean, I take credit for it, but the funny thing is there's probably, you know, some 17th century Italian piece that has that exact form that some blacksmith back then did.
Probably.
Well, I mean, our entire craft is iterative, right? It's you're taking what somebody else does and putting your own spin on it, right?
Even furthermore into that, mankind itself has never invented anything. We have simply just figured out what was already there for us.
Yeah, reinvented and tweaked it into a different form.
Yep. I mean, the word invention, the word invention is kind of, there's like a loose definition on, yeah, you can say, oh yeah, we invented that. But in reality, it was already there for us. We didn't have to really invent something, just figured it out.
Lando's hot philosophical take of the podcast.
Do you mind if we take a quick second here, Matt? A quick break? Give Grumposaurus Rex a chance to go have a quick puff here and we'll reconvene in
Not a problem. No worries.
All right. Thanks, bud. We'll just hit pause here and we'll be right back at it in 2 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, so we're back now here, back for a quick little break for Grumpy McGrumpface to get his nicotine fix, eh?
Gotta have your smoke spice.
Enjoy your smokes. Enjoy
enjoy your smokes. So I wanted to ask, while we're on the topic of style and being able to run your own business and acquire a following per se, do you believe that if your style is good enough, that that can be trumped by your attitude per se? Or do you think that, you know, once you've obtained a level of your, you know, say somebody like Will Stelter, oh geez, I'm forgetting his name right now. The guy that everybody, the guy that you went to the UK and worked with there.
Oh, Alex Steele.
Alex Steele. Once you get to that level of, you know, everybody knows who you are, can you kind of have like a chip on your shoulder and it doesn't matter at that point? You'll still acquire, or you'll still continue to hold your following and keep your business afloat, no problem? Or do you think you kind of got to watch that chip on your shoulder kind of thing? I mean, there's from a personal point of view, I guess, right?
If we're talking about social media following, I would say, yeah, you can retain a following because people love to follow boisterous, loud people. I mean, if you really look at a lot of the like top people on, say, YouTube or something, they're quite the personality. So there is a point, maybe there's a point where you become so incredibly arrogant that you lose following. But, you know, I think, there are people I don't follow because I think their personality is just so abrasive and just like, you know, mm-hmm. you know, they're so stuck on themselves that it's a bit much for me. But at the same time, I think, especially like with social media, it's funny because I hear a lot of people criticize, let's say, Alex Steele. But if you're going to put yourself out there on that, level, you have to have a certain bit of, you know, his personality and certain bit of, you know, I don't give a rip and all of that. And so, you know, there's the amount of people who never post anything because they're terrified, and they're terrified of what people will say, and they don't want any pushback or anything like that. It's astronomical. So if you put yourself out there in the public space, yeah, you do kind of have to grow thick skin quickly. And you know, there's always that part of it. And I think that's what's hard, again, like going back to the difference between somebody who just does a job and somebody who does a job from the heart of like an artist or a craftsman. I think that's what is so difficult for a lot of artists and craftsmen, is to put themselves out there like that. Because if you're producing what I call your true work, it comes from your heart and soul. And so when you put it out there for the world to see and you open yourself up for that criticism, to be vulnerable, man, that is, it's a bit like standing before everyone buck naked and you're vulnerable, and it's hard. It's funny because in keeping with this whole conversation, I've actually begun working on what I'm probably going to present as a video, but it will, why creative self-destruct. And, you know, it kind of plays into some of that whole conversation. It's just, you know, artistry, craftspeople, you know, we do put our heart and soul into what we do. So there is a part of it, putting it out there in the public space, you know, for some people can be intimidating. And, you know, I've gotten negative feedback on stuff I've posted. We all do. You know, it's just,
do you get many honest to goodness shit post replies and stuff?
What's that?
Do you get very many like honest to goodness, like shit post, like people just, throwing negative trolls stuff your way just for,
yeah,
trolls
for the fun of it. Yeah. There's always, one or two of those.
Yeah. That's why I've gotten two thus far.
Yeah. I generally have, you know, I'm big about treating people well and, you know, treating people the way I would want to be treated. But I love having a super sarcastic answer for those lovely people.
Yeah, absolutely.
something so blatant that anyone who reads is like, oh yeah, he didn't quite feel that comment.
Sorry, my dog is going absolutely bonkers behind me. He wants to play with his toy. It's just still kind of a puppy phase here. I'm kind of having a hard time concentrating right now. But anyways, Yeah. So what about when it comes to business? Do you think there's a point where you kind of have to be almost putting on a front that this is the business me? I run a business and I'm serious about it. I don't want to cross a line with anybody. Or do you think that once you've gotten to a point in business that, you know, you're well known enough, you've gained a reputation through your style and what you produce, that you can have that chip on your shoulder that I don't care if I piss off a couple people here or there or whatever, I'll still retain my business good enough that I'll be happy?
Yeah, I think you do get to that level where you can get away with some stuff like that. But I would say my philosophy is like, do what's good for business. So for me, like with my social media, for instance, I keep it about the business. I don't inject politics into it, just like this podcast.
Right.
Like, you know, I try to inject a little bit of my personal family life, but just only a little bit, because that's such a huge part of who I am that I feel like that's part of the business. That's real. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're all putting our, especially on social media, we're all putting our best foot forward. I honestly, over the years though, have tried to make some posts about our failures and be pretty honest with that, because I feel like so many people are so incredibly fake that it's repulsive and everybody's crap stinks. Mm-hmm. And everybody falls flat on their face someday. Some people love to pose and pretend like they don't, but I don't care how successful you are. You make mistakes and you learn from them. And like one of them is my wife, Heidi. She made a great post on our blog about a very high-end table that we did. We delivered it to the client and they hated the finish. So our philosophy was like, man, we're going to make this right. So we took the table back. Completely redid the finish on our dime, which when I say finish on this table, I mean, we're talking about there's so much work, the labor, the patina, the materials. It was like a $3,000 finish. But, you know, we wanted to do that right. We learned from that mistake. And, you know, she actually wrote a blog post on our website about that. And we were honest in the sense of, hey, we made a mistake, but we were also honest in the sense of like, with some of the stuff we're all still learning. So, hey, like here's a part of our business that we were still learning on. But we didn't, one thing that we're all big about is not, you know, settling. We didn't settle on it. We made it right.
Made it right. Yeah. Customer satisfaction's number one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And going back to like the other question, I would say, customer satisfaction is number one. And there's never a point where you get so big that you can do crap work and yeah, not fulfill your customer's desire. Because I constantly told the guys in the shop, we are only as good as our last five jobs. Reputation is everything. You know, you have to do great work. It doesn't matter if we did incredible work 15 years ago. It does in the sense of, you know, that's part of our heritage. That's part of what's built us. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, nobody gives a crap about any of that. What's coming out of the shop doors now? What's coming out of the shop doors today? And holding and maintaining, you know, a great level of work is a whole nother, you know, bag of nails, so to speak. You know, it's, you know, it's another side of it.
So part of the reasoning behind asking that question is I've seen the blacksmithing community absolutely explode in the last, say, 15 years, right? I'm part of that explosion. The maker community exploding with that larger population of people growing in our community. It feels like maybe we're going to start running into the whole, there's enough of us that, you know, crappy work gets hidden, kind of like the whole the packmaskus or crapmaskus that people want to, you know, kind of hate on right now. And for, you know, all due respect, there's a good reasoning behind that, but you know, do you feel like at some point that's going to, that whole approach to business is going to eventually drift over into North America, where there's going to be a lot of people that are not really too concerned about the work they're producing because there's enough of us that the crappy work kind of gets hidden?
Yeah, that's always a philosophy, you know. I mean, I guess what I would say is, like, my approach to the work is, like, there's room at the top. And, you know, this might sound arrogant, but I'm pretty deliberate about who I actually follow on social media, because there's, like, not to be ignorant, but I don't want to follow substandard work. That, and again, I don't look down on anyone, because we're all, like, we're all at different points in the learning curve. It's just, I believe if you want to maintain a high level of work, then you need to, like, be careful about who you surround yourself with. Even, you know, what are you looking at on social media? You know what I mean? Like, kind of like curate your diet of, like, what you're intaking, you know, just to, and that probably sounds arrogant to some people. I don't mean it that way. It's just,
I don't think so, man.
No, there's a whole philosophy, like, of that in this world of, surround yourself by the people that you want to be influenced by, and that's who you become, essentially, is who you surround yourself by, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like surround yourself with great friends. It's just digital.
Yeah. And I mean, when you're seeing stuff in your feed that is really amazing work, that's going to inspire you and drive you to do better work, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yes.
Only logical, yes, it will, but that is going to be a thing.
Right. But if I can flip the lid on that and say that, and this is kind of going into this, like, quote unquote TED talk I've been working on. We as creatives and artists and craftspeople, we're great at falling into the comparison trap as well. And
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, come on now. Like, we all do it. Like,
I feel personally attacked.
You spend so much time looking at other great work and, you know, you compare yourself, you let that, you know, get into your psyche and even, you know, downplay your own work. And, you know, that can be the bad part of social media, but, you know, then it falls into other things like imposter syndrome and just so many other things. You know?
Yeah. It's hard not to suffer from imposter syndrome in our line of work, though. I mean, you have to understand that there's a freaking, a pretty large growth curve that happens throughout the years, and you know, you can only expect so much out of the time you put into it, right?
Man, I still feel like I'm a really enthusiastic beginner.
Yeah, well, and how long have you been doing it for, like, since you were a kid too, right?
Yeah, I think I started when I was about 14.
There you go. Yeah
But that's the beauty of the craft, is like you're constantly learning something new, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
At least I am. I've been at it 27 years. I know a decent amount, you know, my work speaks for itself in that regards, but that's what I love about the work. You're constantly learning something new. And, you know, I tell young guys who are, you know, approaching me about it, it's like, there's not many things you can say that, you know, you'll never know it all, but there's always something, a new discipline, a new way of making a tool, you know, a new, you know, way of working. That's what I love about it.
This is bringing to mind a beautiful question that Victoria Patty used to ask on her podcast all the time. If there was a blacksmith, dead or alive, that you could spend a day working with, who would it be?
Oh man, that's a great question. I always loved that question on her podcast. Shout out to Victoria, because that was a great podcast.
Right.
And I've thought about this, and you're catching me off guard. oh, man. If I could say one modern guy who was, like, just behind me and was alive when I was a kid, an artist out of Philadelphia, Christopher Wray. And he was just, like, a super awesome artist, inspired some other people. I did a Philly tour of ironwork on YouTube. Some of his work was in that. he would fall into that class, and maybe dead Edgar Brandt from France. He was a French Art Deco artist, and yeah, his work was just mind-blowingly incredible.
Solid answers, man.
Yeah, Edgar Brandt, Christopher Wray.
Cool.
Yeah,
cool.
They're both dead, but
no worries.
Different time periods, like 1910 versus 1970, 80, something like that.
I never got to ask my question that I always ask.
Well, yeah, bud.
We had enough time to fit that in. When you're working at the anvil, what is your go-to hammer?
Oh man, go-to hammer. In all honesty, my go-to hammer is a hammer that's an exact copy of one of Mr. Mullenshot's hammers. That is nothing more than I call it a fuller pin hammer, and it's nothing more than a 3-pound, basically classic sledgehammer with like a big fuller ground on the one side of it. And the reason that's my go-to hammer is I find it's better and moves metal faster than a cross peen. It's just like a huge, blunt, wide cross peen. Use it, and my approach to work is probably similar to what a lot of people try to do with a Brian Brazil hammer and that kind of rounding hammer. But I feel that it's more controlled because that face doesn't move the metal in all four directions. It only moves it in, you know, laterally in one direction. So you can change that based upon how you hit it. So, yeah. Long answer, but I'm pretty passionate about that.
Hey, that's all right. Awesome, that's interesting. Answer. So when you say a fuller peen, like the backside of it is just, it's kind of rounded with a similar radius to like a rounding hammer, but only in one direction?
Yeah, it would be as if you cut a piece of 1.5-inch round and welded it on the end of the hammer.
There you go.
But
that's
like
what
cross,
I was
going to
ask, cross
face.
The radius.
Crossface. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty much like a top tool, almost like a top tool for fullering, but it's a hammer.
No.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Cool. And what do you have for an anvil? What's your go-to anvil?
The main anvil in the shop, again, like working up and you know, getting to where you want to be, is a 650-pound beautiful forged German anvil. Ooh, love that thing.
Bam!
Yeah, our second anvil is a huge hay button, 464-pound hay button. Those are two main anvils.
That's a big hay button. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you already told us where you started. You started on railroad track.
Yep. Yep.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And what have you been listening to in the shop lately?
Oh, man. I listen to anything and everything. So, good song, like a surprise song. I guess you say I listen to blues a lot. So anything Gary Williams Jr. I love his stuff. Guilty pleasure song would be like a band called the 1975. They're like totally teeny bopper music on one hand, but I'm a musician too, so I just love their. The way they write and their sound overall. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, Chocolate by the 1975.
Nice.
It's not a song you would think a blacksmith would like, but it's.
You have not heard how many crazy weird things I've put on this playlist. This real oddball stuff.
Well, let's get another one from you there, bud.
Yeah,
it's not so oddball, but I've actually been listening to a fair bit of bluegrass in the shop.
Oh, sweet.
Oh, yeah.
And the one in particular that I'm thinking of is Roanoke by Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys.
Roanoke.
Which is like super old school, but it's pretty awesome.
By who again?
Bill Monroe and Bill the Monroe. Bluegrass Boys.
Cool.
Got it.
Give me a sec here. Go to my...
I'm making sure this playlist is so eclectic. I put in, like, classical and death metal and all sorts of shit.
How about I give you guys a Bill McClintock mix? He did a song... was it the boys that Men Down Under that did? Is that the guys from Australia? It was Men Down Under, right?
I have no idea, dude.
Fuck, why, where's the song now? Ah, damn it. That was a song I wanted to do. Damn it. Bill McClintock with Metallica and Son of a Gun. It was the... It's got to be... I don't know. Whatever. I'll just put it on the show notes. It was a Bill McClintock song with Metallica.
Okay.
Metallica 1 mixed with... I want to say it was Men Down Under. I could be wrong. Anyways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got you now. Yep.
Okay. Yep. I'm talking.
Just clicked.
This is completely foreign to me. I have no idea. I'll have to go look it up after.
What was it? Okay. Anyways. Good. Didn't talk about Twiller at all.
Oh, yes. We need to make sure.
Have you gotten any yet, yes. Nick?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I thought you ordered some. Shoot.
No, I didn't end up actually ordering any. I've run into a tiny conflict of interest on that one.
Oh, okay. Well, anyways. Yeah. Matt, if you're interested, we have a sponsor from Saskatchewan, Saskatchewan, Canada, sorry. He's making his own linseed oil and presses it, grows it, and you can save yourself 10% on orders $50 or more at detwillerlinseed.com on some awesome food-grade, safe linseed oil products.
Awesome.
Yeah. Outside of that, bud, was there anything else that you wanted to get out today, or?
No, I mean, as a wrap up, I'll throw out there, this is more for anyone down south. I'm going to be demonstrating for the Louisiana Metalsmiths Association next year, their conference, March 9th and 10th. That's down in Louisiana. So that's a fun sidebar thing outside the shop that I have going on. Now, if anyone wants to check out our work, it's MatthewHarris.studio. That's the website. Matthew Harris Studio on Instagram and YouTube. So yeah, we try to put out a lot of different stuff that we're doing. And, we have our own hammer-in that we host. It's always the third or fourth Saturday in October. You never know who's going to demonstrate at that. We've had anybody from myself, my friend Mike Robert. We had Will Stelter 2 years ago. Just a ton of great, talented people. But the whole idea behind that event is like kick open the shop doors, let everybody come hang out. There's a ton of amazing people that show up to that event. And I believe in cultivating community in your work. And it's tough to shut down, clean up, host an event like that, but it's been as beneficial for us as it's been for anyone who's come to it. But yeah,
it's always cool worthwhile.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
I agree, man. Well, we got the Manitoba Blacksmith Guild going. We're doing the same thing down or up here, I guess. Down here. Up here.
North is up, right?
Yes, I think so. Depends which way you look at it. Are you one of those flat earther types? Anyways. Let's throw the sheepskin on this one and wrap her up with a good old
good day.
Oh,
ba 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 ba.
Awesome, man. Thanks again, Matt. That was an
awesome talk. I really wish we could keep on going for more, but I know you're a very busy person and we want to let you get back to your business. And
yeah, man,
it was amazing that you gave us the time, dude. Yeah.
Hey, man, it was an honor to be on with you guys, and I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun hanging out with you.
Oh, come on. Let's not go too far. An honor.
Yeah, geez, wow.
Hanging out with two host heads for an hour and a half.
No, it was a lot of fun.
Well, I appreciate it.
As long as it was fun, it's worth it.
I had a blast, too.
All right.
Okay, well, do this. Look.
Good day.